Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, April 5th, 2016. United Nations agencies warn of increasing food shortages and widespread hunger in South Sudan.
With a deficit of almost about 400,000 metric tons, typically the country would bridge that gap through imports. The imports are no longer able to meet that gap.
And authorities in UAE say armed rebels are not the problem, it is highway criminals.
It was a day for the market of Payawa, and so many vehicles were going there, so they stopped all the people who are going to the market. They don't allow somebody to see their faces, but the fact remains that they are very many. They are well armed, and they only take money.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. United Nations aid agencies today say the conflict in South Sudan, combined with recent poor weather patterns, have further reduced crop production in the country. The UN says South Sudan's cereal production is down by about 400,000 metric tons this year. The situation has aggravated the already severe food shortages across the country. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
The UN's Food and Agricultural Organization and World Food Programme say South Sudan's crop production has been slashed by 53% compared to last year's numbers. The agency's estimates stem from a joint crop and food assessment report conducted across the country from November 30th to December 18th in 2015. Mario Zappacosta is an economist with the FAO's Global Information and Early Warning System, Trade and Markets Division in South Sudan.
The 2015 cropping season was affected by, let's say, two main factors. In some areas by unfavorable weather and in some other by the conflict.
Former states like Western Equatoria were once referred to as the food basket of South Sudan. But this time round, production has been so poor due to the fighting between government forces and Arab boys. Zappacosta says some 400,000 metric tons of food will be needed to fill the food gap deficit. And he says food insecurity is worsening all across the country, not just in the most conflict-prone areas of Greater Upper Nile, but also in places like Northern Bahr El Ghazal and Lake States. These latest estimates from UN agencies come at a time when other humanitarian aid groups were already reporting that most families are feeding on one meal per day because of the skyrocketing prices of food and other commodities. Bernard Owadi, head of the WFP Food Security and Vulnerability Analysis in South Sudan, says the situation is expected to worsen because of the economic crisis. He says food prices are four or five times what they were just a few months ago. Owadi says traders are not able to import as many commodities as they were before because they face many constraints along the main roads.
What is significant at this point in time is that due to the depreciation of the local currency, due to the economic downturn, the imports are no longer able to meet that gap.
The agencies are calling for immediate action to address the hunger and strengthen domestic food production. Zappacosta says if seeds and tools are provided, the communities can produce their own food to withstand market disruptions.
Both the international community and the local institution to try to improve the food security situation in the coming months.
The World Food Programme and Food and Agricultural Organization both say the most urgent need is an immediate improvement in security across the country. They say they need sustained access and resources to provide targeted food and livelihood assistance to the most vulnerable households experiencing the highest levels of food insecurity, especially in parts of Greater Upper Nile and Eastern Equatoria. In February, the FAO, UNICEF and the WFP warned that South Sudan was facing unprecedented levels of food insecurity, saying 2.8 million people, about a quarter of the country's population, remain in urgent need of food assistance. They said at least 40,000 people are on the brink of catastrophe. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The governor of the newly created Yei state has ordered organized forces to patrol roads leading to the state after unknown gunmen killed five people and wounded several others earlier this month. VOA fellow Tito Justin has this story for VOA from Yei.
Governor David Lokonga Moses says 42 businessmen and women were tortured and their property looted, and more than 200,000 South Sudanese pounds were stolen from businessmen and women in just 1 month. He says women reported being ordered to remove their dresses. Lokonga describes the crimes committed against civilians as serious and is appealing for a quick intervention from the national government authorities in Juba.
The state government is mandated to protect its people and properties. That means the whole people residing in Yei River State, in the poor counties, being foreigners, nationals, have right to be protected.
Authorities have yet to identify the unknown gunmen operating in the state. Last month, State Deputy Governor Abraham Wani said the armed men in the state are rebels, but today Lokonga said they are nothing more than highway robbers. One of the survivors of last week's road attacks, who does not want his name to be mentioned for fear of retribution, says his phone and some £250 were stolen from him. He says more than 80 gunmen attacked him.
Actually, that day was Monday. It was a day for the market of Payawa. And so many vehicles were going there. So they stopped all the people who are going to the market. They don't allow somebody to see their faces. But the fact remains that there are very many. They are well-armed and they only take money.
Another survivor, Joyce Chandiru, who was shot in the leg last month while traveling on Yei Morobu County Road, says the attackers were dressed in military uniforms. Chandiru says she was shot by the gunman who stole 1,500 South Sudanese pounds from her. Lokonga is calling on residents to report any and all suspects.
My people in Yei River State, you should cooperate. You should work together. You should welcome anybody who might have been out during the crisis and peace has been signed. These are our brothers. These are your sisters. Welcome them well. Embrace them. And what we want to underline here is we want peaceful coexistence and we want prosperity.
Last month, unknown gunmen kidnapped three wildlife officers and stole 40 machine guns in the state's Morobo County. The whereabouts of the missing wildlife officers is still unknown. For VOA News, I am Tiro Justin in Yei.
Religious leaders from the former Central Equatorial State want the warring parties to expedite implementation of the peace deal and put an end to the suffering of the people. Bishops from the Episcopal Church of Sudan and South Sudan say despite the August peace agreement, tens of thousands of people across the country continue to suffer. Mungume Debs Rakarinj has more for VOA from Juba.
Church leaders issued a statement in the capital yesterday following a three-day meeting in Tirikeka County. Bishop Hilale Luwate Adeba from Yei Diocese of the Episcopal Church of Sudan and South Sudan read the statement which called on South Sudan's leaders to implement the August peace deal immediately.
We urge the peace partners to expedite that process in order for the government of national unity to address the challenges facing the people of South Sudan.
Humanitarian agencies are warning of a looming famine unless the fighting ends immediately so people can go home and cultivate their land. Adeba says while church leaders commend the small steps taken so far toward ending the conflict, the warring parties must move quickly.
We are concerned, however, about the deteriorating economic situation in the country and the growing insecurity in Equatorial and other regions in South Sudan despite the signing of peace agreement in August 2015. However, we are grateful to hear progress made on the implementation of the peace process and the remaining steps towards formation of a transitional government of national unity.
So far, more than 600 SPLA-IO forces have returned to Juba ahead of the return of former rebel leader Riek Machar to the capital, which is expected sometime next week. Bishop Adeba says the South Sudanese people have suffered long enough.
Many people from across our dioceses are now experiencing food shortages, and this situation is likely to get worse between now and the next harvest in July 2016, assuming that the rains start in April 2016. We appeal to the government, United Nations agencies, and other humanitarian agencies to intervene with the needed food assistance for both IDPs and drought-affected areas to avert further humanitarian disasters.
Church leaders who attended the 3 days of meetings were from the dioceses of Terekeka, Lenya, Rokon, Kajokeji, Rejef, and Yei. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the president of Sudan tours all 5 states of Darfur. That story after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
in your opinion, what are the best ways to fight corruption?
To fight corruption, our people need to be enlightened, and there should be a system in place. We need to strengthen our institutions, because if institutions are strong enough, then I'm sure corruption will be minimized.
By setting up tribunal, it worked really very, very smooth for Burkinabes, and in that way, Burkina Faso almost realized their dream, which was fighting corruption.
The best is to have strong institutions which are independent, like the Anti-Corruption Commission must be independent of all that proceedings, giving them powers to investigate, to prosecute, and all that.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about in vitro fertilization. Millions of babies have been born via in vitro fertilization since the method was first developed in Britain in 1978. But IVF technology has been slow to catch in sub-Saharan Africa. Rahel Ombor reports for VOA from Nairobi.
The Nairobi IVF Center opened in 2004 and has since helped more than 2,000 infertile couples have biological children, says head of operations Joy Nori.
Suburban African does not mean you are primitive. It is just lack of knowledge in some people that they didn't understand what IVF is. But once you explain what the treatment protocol entails, they basically understand and embrace it.
In vitro fertilization, or IVF, involves extracting the egg and fertilizing it with the man's sperm outside the body. The embryo is then inserted into the woman's uterus. Nore says the clinic has a 55% success rate. A single cycle costs the equivalent of about $4,000.
Treatment is for that person, that specific couple, that desperately desires to have a child and they are proposed at whatever cost. They will get that child. It is not classified for rich or poor. It's for the psychologically charged person that they need a baby.
It is not just the high cost keeping Kenyans away from IVF. Some people say scientists should not be playing God. Less invasive medical treatments for infertility have become popular in Kenya, such as taking the prescription medicine Clomid to spur ovulation. Other women follow dietary recommendations and seek out traditional herbal treatments. Some couples turn to prayer. Grace and Peter Miner live in a leafy suburb of Nairobi. Their nieces stayed with them over the Easter weekend. The couple have been trying to have a baby for 5 years.
We have read about the IVF and made a decision not to have the IVF. Way because we have always believed in natural way of doing things. Being Christians and more so Africans, we believe that God is the giver of children. Yeah.
he says they plan to adopt if they cannot have children naturally. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move to Khartoum, where Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir wrapped up a five-day tour of all five states of Darfur today. The president's visit happened just a few days before Darfur residents go to the polls in an administrative referendum to decide how the region should be governed. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Khartoum.
Sudan Information Minister Ahmed Bilal, who accompanied Mr. Bashir and other top officials on the tour of Darfur, says there are two reasons President Bashir decided to visit Darfur now.
The first reason that we think Darfur now is completely free of any rebels, not any single area occupied by the rebels. And now Darfur in peace, the roads are open between the cities, people are going freely.
The second reason, Bilal says, was to assure the people of Darfur that the upcoming referendum will be carried out as scheduled.
For fulfilling the right of the people, according to Doha agreement, they have to do the referendum. And people are ready now on the 11th to go and vote for their choice, whether it is for states or for one region.
During his visit to the capitals of each of the region's five states, Mr. Bashir inaugurated a number of development projects. He told residents his government will deliver better education and healthcare services to the people of Darfur. Bilal says after the referendum, the national government will work on disarming Darfur. He says only regular forces will be allowed to carry weapons so that peace can prevail in the troubled region.
When you come and you hand over your arms, you will be paid back for this. After some time, it will be obligatory. If you didn't come and then they find with you this, it will be confiscated and you will be subjected to law.
Khartoum-based political commentator Faisal Mohamed Saleh notes that President Bashir's visit to Darfur also comes in the wake of the recent defeat of the rebels of Abdul Wahid Nur in Jabal Marra. Saleh says Mr. Bashir is in effect telling the world that he is in charge of the whole country.
So they want to say that everything now is peaceful and that there is no any presence of the armed rebels in most of the five states of the four regions. And actually they have stated that directly in the president's speech in all the states he visited in Jinena, in Zalingay, in northern Darfur in Al-Fashir and in Niala, and he's going to eastern Darfur in Abdi'in, and he stated that clearly.
Saleh says Mr. Bashir is also looking to gain more credibility from the international community ahead of the upcoming referendum.
And I think also they want to send a message to the outside world to accept the result of referendum, whatever the result is, and to close the door of any proposed negotiation about peace in Darfur again.
But Saleh says it will be impossible for the government to successfully disarm anti-government forces in Darfur. He says what the government can do is disarm its own militias that it uses to fight the rebels. He says it's important for the government to open a direct dialogue with the rebels if it is truly wants to restore lasting peace in Darfur.
The only way is to enter in a new negotiation with them. So I don't expect any positive development in Darfur after the referendum. And I think we are still looking for a new approach to try to end the conflict in Darfur. And I don't think the current approach can reach any point.
Voting in the Darfur administrative referendum begins on Monday and will continue for 3 days. Residents of Darfur will be voting to either keep the current five states or establish one region with a semi-autonomous administration. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists is looking at millions of documents leaked that implicate dozens of world leaders and wealthy elites of tax evasion. The documents were leaked from a Panamanian law firm, which showed how dozens of country leaders and wealthy elites have used offshore and hidden accounts to create loopholes for dodging taxes and sanctions. Ian Beer has more.
It's being called the biggest documents leak in history. Over 11 million internal papers from the Panamanian law firm Mossack Fonseca, who specializes in creating offshore companies, have connected at least 140 politicians from more than 50 countries of quietly establishing offshore companies and potentially evading taxes. Former Sudanese President Ahmad al-Mirghani, who was ousted after just 2 years in office by President Omar al-Bashir, has been implicated in the Panama Papers. J.R. Maley, a policy analyst at the Washington, D.C.-based Enough Project, says there are all kinds of reasons why a powerful individual would purchase an offshore company.
So it's not just tax evasion. A wide range of individuals use these sorts of entities, from people who have to do it for completely legitimate purposes, like, you know, perhaps property developers who are trying to stave off price gouging, to a wide range of nefarious purposes. So there are folks that use these sorts of entities for sanctions busting, for, you know, siphoning off money from state coffers in the case of politicians. You know, essentially anyone who wants to hide what their economic dealings are has a use for anonymous shell companies. And that's the crux of the problem.
Al-Mirghani purchased Orange Star Corporation in 1995, a company located in the British Virgin Islands. That same year, the ousted president, who was exiled to Egypt, purchased a string of apartments for $600,000 near Hyde Park in London. At the time of his death in 2008, the Panama Papers report that Al-Mirghani held assets through the Orange Star Corporation for more than $2.7 million. Maley cautions there is not enough evidence to accuse al-Mirghani or any of his associates of any illegal activities.
You know, he used an anonymous shell company to purchase about $600,000 worth of real estate in London. You know, that in itself isn't very shocking, but whenever you're considering the activities of a current or former head of state, when there is an anonymous shell company involved to conceal the transaction, that should trigger alarm bells and should trigger enhanced scrutiny by any other parties involved in those transactions.
Mossack Fonseca is one of the leading creators of shell companies, according to the Center for Public Integrity. Maley warns that these offshore companies are not illegal.
To be sure, there may be instances where it's appropriate for folks to want to, you know, hide where they own a home, for example. However, when a senior politician or their immediate family member uses an anonymous shell company to conceal transactions in which they're involved, that should immediately trigger alarm bells and extra scrutiny.
Former President Ahmad al-Mirghani is the only African leader directly implicated in the leak. The Panama Papers has implicated six other African leaders through relations with colleagues or family. For example, Alaa Mubarak, the son of former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, also bought an offshore company through Mossack Fonseca. Munir Mahidi, the personal secretary to the King of Morocco, has also been named in the papers, as has the nephew of South African President Jacob Zuma. Mossack Fonseca has denied any wrongdoing. The law firm says the majority of their clients are regulated entities and insists that all of them are well-known and reputable companies and firms. Ayan Buer, VOA News, Washington.
And then we move to Nairobi for some breaking news. The International Criminal Court has dropped charges against Kenyan Deputy President William Ruto. The ICC said today that judges voted 2-1 to vacate the charges against Ruto and co-defendant Joshua Arap Sang. Ruto was charged with being responsible for acts of murder, forceful transfer of population and persecution during the 2007 and 2008 post-election violence in Kenya. Sang, a Kenyan radio journalist, was accused of playing a role in the same crimes. Reporter Lenin Rovaga in Nairobi says some 1,100 Kenyans were killed during the weeks of ethnic violence that followed the disputed polls.
That the Sang case has been terminated without prejudice to re-prosecution in future. And what this means that essentially the case has been closed. And the scene in Nairobi is one of calmness. However, in Eldoret, which, as you well know, is the stronghold of Deputy President William Samoei Ruto and the broadcaster Sang, this is where they hail from. This is largely where the ethnic community comes from, the Rift Valley. So scenes in Eldoret are one of pandemonium. People are excited, and we've had sporadic people going to the streets, chanting songs in praise of both the Deputy President and indeed the broadcaster sang.
Initially, rights groups in East Africa, especially the community-based activists in Nairobi, were pressing hard that President Kenyatta and his deputy have to face justice for the alleged crimes committed during the post-election violence. How are the civil society groups reacting to this news?
It's quite instructive to realize that the civil society in Kenya is split across political divide. Now, it depends on which side the bread is buttered. Indeed, the International Commission of Jurists have said that the quest for justice, and if I can quote them, the executive director, Mr. Sam Muhochi, has said the quest for justice for the victims and the IDPs has come to an end and they will not get any recompense whatsoever. So it's a sad day for them. And I had a chat with him a few minutes ago, and this was his stand. However, Okiya Omtatah, a different civil rights activist who has been against the ICC and its processes from the beginning, Hitharto, has said that indeed it is a day of jubilation.
And how is the reaction in Central Province, where President Uhuru Kenyatta comes from?
Now, in Central Province, the reaction is calm, just like Nairobi. You do realize that the people who were on the stand were coming. The other four have been acquitted, indeed. And when the president was let go, Central Province erupted, you know, unanimously and sporadically in jubilation. And this is exactly what we're seeing now in Eldoret. In Central Province, their reaction is muted and calm, although they were also pushing here politically and also judicially to have the cases dropped and were throwing all their weight behind the deputy president and indeed Sang. So in Central Province, to answer your question, is that it's one of calmness, but it's a restrained calmness, and they too indeed are happy about this.
And how about the other political forces in the country? How is the reaction from the camp of ODM, Raila Odinga and the rest?
The ODM camp has been mute for the moment, but I don't expect this to be so in the next hour. They have been mute, no press statements from them. No political heavyweight has come to the screen to give a press conference. So no one as yet from the core opposition side has come either to support or to lambast the decision by the ICC. As of now, no one has reacted from the opposition side. I gather and I tend to think that they're putting their collective heads together to come up with a more comprehensive political statement, because indeed the ruling has got ramifications, not just now, Mr. Tanza, but you do realize that Kenya is going to an election next year, so this ruling has got ramifications across the divide on the electoral system, the judiciary system, and also the state security machinery.
That's VOA's Lenin Ruvaga speaking to me this past hour from Nairobi. And that brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Marina by Sam Mapangala. We have been listening to Sam Mapangala with the song Marina. I'm John Tanza in Washington. I'm glad you could join us. Continue to be with us tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.